Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. And if you're listening to this, you know that the NBN is the largest academic podcast network in the world. We reach a worldwide audience of 2 million people. You may have a podcast, or you may be thinking about starting a podcast. As you probably know, there are challenges. Basically, of two kinds. One is technical. There are things you have to know in order to get your podcast produced and distributed. And the second is, and this is the biggest problem, you need to get an audience. Building an audience in podcasting is the hardest thing to do today. With this in mind, we at the NBN have started a service called NBN Productions. What we do is help you create a podcast, produce your podcast, distribute your podcast, and we host your podcast. Most importantly, what we do is we distribute your podcast to the NBN audience. We've done this many times with many academic podcasts, and we would like to help you. If you would be interested in talking to us about how we can help you with your podcast, please contact us. Just go to the front page of the New Books Network, and you will see a link to NBN Productions. Click that, fill out the form, and we can talk.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com and on Instagram and Twitter at burnedbybooks. Let's start the show. When the big one hits, the giant Cascadia earthquake that scientists assure us will come eventually, Emma Patti's very pregnant protagonist, Annie, is shopping for a crib at IKEA. Thus begins Emma's electrifying novel of Earth's angry upheaval, Tilt, out now with Mary Sue Ritchie Books. Annie will extract herself from the IKEA, something that is difficult enough to do even on non-disaster days, only to find her home city of Portland nearly unrecognizable and suffering through brutal aftershocks of the quake. Annie then must cross the riven landscape to try and find her husband, who has gone downtown for an acting audition, but has not been heard from since the earthquake. Along the way, she will encounter every form of humanity, anger and fear, danger and selfishness, but also kindness and deep empathy, and radical forms of love for strangers, all of which is narrated to Annie's unborn child, who she calls Bean. For Bean, who sits on the precipice between dependency and birth, the world will, from the first, be about profound loss and change, but also about the power of motherhood and the strength of bonds between women. A harrowing and yet hopeful tale of a probable catastrophe, Tilt shows us our undeniable flaws and solipsisms while reserving its most powerful work for a paean to the capability of ordinary people to hold grief and still keep moving forward. Emma Patti is a climate journalist and a fiction writer living in Portland, Oregon. She's written about climate change for The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Guardian, and more. In 2021, she coined the term climate shadow to describe an individual's potential impact on climate change. Her fiction has appeared in Bellevue Literary Review, Idaho Review, New Orleans Review, Carve Magazine, Citron Review, and Alaska Quarterly Review. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you, Chris.
Let's start with IKEA. There is perhaps no commercial space more loaded with interpersonal tension than the Swedish furniture megastore. How did you think about leveraging that pre-existing tension with a catastrophe that would layer on, quite literally, the weight of people and damage and things?
It's funny, I really have a love affair with IKEA. And so I put it in the book, you know, from that perspective. And it's funny how many people have said to me, oh, it makes sense the book is at IKEA because I hate IKEA. I get so lost there. It's so awful there. And I haven't sort of had the heart to admit how much I love it. And for me, you know, I have memories of, you know, shopping for my college dorm at IKEA, shopping for a couch, you know, with my first boyfriend at IKEA. I went with my, you know, when my grandmother became too old to go up her stairs, she and I went to IKEA to buy the mattress for her sort of new room on the main floor. And, you know, and that was one of my last memories with her. You know, so I think IKEA, and then if, and then I also found myself very pregnant at IKEA shopping for a crib. And and so I think for me, you know, there was this incredible nostalgia and sort of sentimental reasoning. But also, you know, for me, this book is very much about consumption and consumerism and consumer identities. And I know that that it can be sometimes hard to parse that when you're reading such a sort of thrill, you know, an action-packed plot. But for me, that's that really is the core of the book. And so I chose a place that has so much sort of class aspiration. And
interesting
in the sense of like, you know, it's funny, at one point somebody suggested to me, we'll just put it in Bed Bath and Beyond. And I was like, oh, no. She's like, she would never shop there. And they're like, we'll just put it in West Elm. And it's like, she can't afford West Elm. And in fact, there used to be a part of a chapter of the book of her standing outside West Elm, looking at the crib she wished she could afford. And so it was so important to me that it be at IKEA. And then of course, because there's only one IKEA in Portland, it's in a very sort of distinctive spot in the city. That changed everything about the book and really sort of set me off on this very specific path geographically with Annie's journey.
So you've put it in the precise location then.
Yeah, everything in the book is in its exact location. And
yeah, because you've got this beautiful illustrated map for us at the beginning that gives us a real sense of Portland and where everything existed. And I did assume that it was mostly geographically correct, but I didn't want to take it for granted.
Totally. Yeah, no, it was very important to me that it be, you know, really scientifically accurate, even in terms of like how long it takes her to walk down any like particular street and the buildings that she sees. Like the only thing I really was intentional about is that I didn't include people's houses. So if it describes a house that has been destroyed, that's a house from a different part of the city that I just moved to that street. Because I didn't want anyone to feel like their specific house was getting called out, and I didn't want to impact house values. And, you know, and I also, there's a scene in an elementary school, and that I actually changed towards the end of writing the book. I moved that from an actual elementary school to a location that is not an elementary school so that people didn't feel, yeah, like it, just for ethical reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tilt is narrated as a letter or a personal history of Annie's experiences of the quake told to her unborn child. What was evocative about a narration to a being that is mediated from the experience of trauma by another body?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was very taken with stream of consciousness novels, and that's really what I set out to try and do. And you know, and as I was writing it, people kept saying, well, this is kind of boring. You have to add more. You have more things need to happen than just a woman sort of walking and thinking. But I was really taken with not only stream of consciousness, but with the way that we enter back into stream of consciousness after a really shocking event. You know, I've obviously, so many of us have had personal experience with that. But there's also like a, you know, there's a significant historical record about that. And people talk about sort of what they were thinking right after 9/11, going down those stairs. People talk about what they were thinking, you know, waiting for hours after an earthquake to see their family, to be reunited with their family. And so I was very taken with this idea that sort of the worst thing can happen. And 30 minutes later, our brain will start to say some really wild stuff to us and start to sort of notice small things and think horrible thoughts and think silly thoughts, and that it kind of cannot maintain long-standing gravitas. And, you know, when I started writing this book, I was pregnant. And so I think I understood it as stream of consciousness. And it's funny now, having kids and also learning more about the science or the sort of emerging research around how much a fetus can actually absorb from their parent and sort of the potential that there may be some more telepathic connection there. I now see the book very differently. That she really is sort of more in dialogue with a being, but I don't know that she even knows that. I think in a sense, you know, she's earnestly kind of, and maybe half-heartedly talking to this, to her unborn child. But I think in the moment, Annie does think, well, you don't know what I'm saying.
But it's the need for a interlocutor that drives her then.
Totally. And the way that sort of, you know, Annie's she's very stuck. And I wanted to really show the way that a person who is that stuck tries to explain themselves to another person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And since you brought it up, I was very interested in the balance between, I mean, this is a very well plotted novel in terms of its action and its pacing. But you seem to say that it was really, you know, a novel of walking and thinking at the beginning, and it's both of those now, and it's a very interior novel at the same time being, you know, just by necessity exterior, as we've got the like cracked landscape all around. But how did you finally come to that balance?
Yeah, you know, I initially wrote a novel that was Annie leaving IKEA. IKEA's sort of up in an industrial area on the outside of town, and where I had her living, you could sort of walk home. It's a straight shot along the river. It would take a long time. You know, it would take hours and hours and hours, but you wouldn't even go through the city. And I had the draft I wrote, she was just sort of walking, and along the way she meets people and she, you know, interacts with some animals, and, you know, different things happen. And of course everybody was like, well, this is boring. And also that, you know, you cannot have an earthquake hit a major city and then not show the city. Like, that's just not reasonable. And those are all great points. But I think actually what I see as the change that happened is that, you know, I really wanted to write a novel about a person who was very stuck and who had this shock event happen. And the way we all do when a shock event happens, we have an opportunity to really change our lives. And I wanted to show that journey. And the problem with what I was doing is that nothing happens to her. Right? She's a stuck person walking, thinking. And I think where the book has ended up now is very similar to the journey I've had to go on as a person in the past sort of 5-6 years writing this book, that is really about other people. It's about connection. It's about a sense of yourself in the fabric of the world. And so it makes so much sense to me that in my late 20s, pregnant, writing this book, I was like, no, she's just going to intellectually muse for about 15 hours. And, you know, and you have some capitalism musings and some ecological musings. And then, of course, just make a grand decision to change her life. And I would say me now in my 30s with 2 kids, you know, very, very connected to climate change. I really see that a person, the change she is making is from isolation to being part of a community.
Mm.
And so that for me is the shift that the book took. And that for me is why I think I was really off course with that first draft. And it was more about being able to flex some of my grand thoughts about the world and the meaning of it all. And all of the people that brought me back to sanity and sort of grounded me, you know, I owe them a lot of gratitude.
Mm. It's nice to have people who can tell you those things truthfully, because it does. You know, it does end up with something that it seems like you're much happier with. You say in your acknowledgments that you wanted this novel to be as accurate as possible in representing what scientists predict the Cascadia earthquake will be like. Can you describe a little bit what the predicted outcomes of the quake may be? And can you talk about how your career as a journalist inflects your desire to represent the real stakes of a potential catastrophe, but in fiction?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think that in journalism, there are some big ethical questions about like how much to scare people, and this idea that like you don't scare people just for the sake of scaring them. And I think
that might be done now in journalism, sadly.
Touché, Chris. Look at you. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair, Chris. Well noted.
I feel scared and purposefully scared in one direction or not every day. But
thank you. No, I actually so appreciate that you called that out, because one of my sort of challenges with the future of my career in media is about the clickbaity energy and the sort of just actual you know, clicks as the product. And I do think that it does lead to some real scare tactics, especially in the topic of climate change. And sometimes that's the opposite. It leads to like some real whitewashing of information, because otherwise people won't read it. And that also is really scary when you talk about climate change. So putting that aside, you are absolutely correct. The way I have approached journalism with this big ethical weight of sort of like, I'm not going to scare people just to scare them. There has to be a purpose. And And so it was really, really important to me that I wasn't going to overstate what the experience of Cascadia might be like and freak people out. And also it was very important to me that I wasn't going to understate it and continue and reinforce the apathy that I really see all around me, whether it's about the earthquake, whether it's about climate change right now, whether it's about, you know, fascism. Yeah. And so, yeah, I really wanted to make sure that every single detail was validated. And I had, you know, geologists read the book. I hired a graduate student to research. I mean, he pulled the building records from IKEA so that we could validate how IKEA would actually fare. So he pulled building records all along the route. He did an incredibly deep amount of research. And we went through sort of every single detail. Like, I was sort of looking back at this and I found 2 pages of research about at what point for this one line in the book that's like the lights flickered and went out. And like that, we did 2 pages of research on when the lights would go out and if they would flicker or not. And so, you know, I probably took it too far. I don't think that the team, you know, I don't think that Mary Sue, I think I'm sure at times she sort of rolled her eyes, but she was very, very kind and very indulgent about it, as was my agent. And it was just, yeah, incredibly important to me. But also, you know, I live in this city. I know these people. Like, it's one thing to talk to you or to talk to, you know, I've talked to a lot of booksellers and readers in other parts of the country who are so, you know, like, I'm so freaked out. Oh my gosh, that was so terrifying. But when I talk to someone here, or worse, when it's like the parent of one of my kids' friends, you know, I sometimes feel like a jerk that I wrote this. And, you know, it feels bad to make people feel scared. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was being so diligent with every single fact.
It's summertime and the weather is nice, and you probably like to entertain out of doors. I know that I do. I do it all the time in my backyard where I have a very nice patio. Well, you need to put something on that patio so people have a place to sit and eat, and Wayfair is your one-stop shop for outdoor entertaining. If you're having a cookout, you need patio tables, grills, dishware, or a pool party or something like that, lounge chairs, day beds. Well, you can get them all at Wayfair. Personally, I like to keep things simple. My patio is not very large, so I have a simple wooden patio table with 4 chairs and an umbrella in case it rains. You don't have to go simple like I did. Wayfair has a huge selection of outdoor items, and it makes it easy to find exactly what's right for you. So maybe you have a big patio, and if you do, you can get something that suits a larger space. Wayfair offers free and easy delivery, even on the really big stuff. Shop outdoor furniture, grills, lawn games, and way more for way less. Head to wayfair.com right now to explore a huge outdoor selection. That's wayfair.com, Wayfair. Every style, every home.
Yeah. Well, it feels texturally very, very much like verisimilitude, which is scary, but it's also, I mean, I think it's a profound thing to be able to represent that and to give us a vision of something that is, you know, if not in our lifetimes, a likelihood for human existence. And I wonder if you would read from a bit of the beginning of the quake in a chapter called Noonish, just to give us a feel of those beginning moments for Annie.
Yeah, I would love to. Though I would just say that the Cascadia earthquake is 37% chance it's going to happen in the next 50 years. So I would say there's actually a high likelihood it will happen in our lifetimes.
Wow.
So I'm just going to throw that out there. That's
no, please.
A very validated fact that the earthquake is actually overdue.
Okay. 31%, is that?
37, yeah, 37% chance it'll happen in the next 50 years.
That's creepy.
And I believe that number goes up when you look at smaller quakes from the fault line. So I believe that's actually just for this massive earthquake.
Okay.
Yeah, with that.
With that in mind.
With that, let's start reading. Okay, Noonish, aisle 8, IKEA warehouse, Northeast Portland. The next big jolt knocks me to the ground. I put my hands out in front of me to catch myself from falling on my stomach, screaming all around me, glass breaking, the lights overhead sparking, the racks are swaying side to side, metal groaning. A cardboard box lands on the floor in front of me with a crack. There's a wave underneath me, lifting me up and then down. A cart spinning backwards across the aisle. The girl with the yellow shirt reaching towards me, her face smeared in panic, but then she falls sideways and is gone. All the suction of the earth is pulling me backwards. I try to reach the rack where the crib was, but the ground keeps shifting, knocking me back and forth between boxes and the metal legs of the racks. How long has it been? 3 minutes? More? The shaking is all around me, inside me. I can't remember what solid ground feels like. Boxes are coming down faster now, exploding around me in bursts of cardboard and dust. I am on my hands and knees, shielding my stomach. We're going to die. You, Bean. Little eyelashes and fingernails, tiny unfurled soul, all of my alternate lives spinning out away from me like frisbees, a playwright in Brooklyn with well-watered houseplants on my windowsill, me and your father at a party in LA, standing by a pool that is lit up by purple and pink lights, ice cubes clinking in our glasses. Someone is laughing at a joke I made. In my backyard, on my knees, gardening in the sun, you're right next to me, little hands in the dirt. I could have been anything, gone anywhere. I crawl into a shallow pocket of space between a stack of flat boxes and the bottom shelf. The boxes are sliding beneath me, and I cling to the metal legs of the rack as they sway back and forth in my hands, giant boxes of furniture hitting the ground in thunderclaps. I curl my body into a shrimp shape around you. Black blackness. The lights are out, crashing and screaming all around me, distant thunderclaps. A siren starts blaring in slow pulses. I can't see anything, not even my own hand in front of me. The building rocking. It's going to fall down. My fingers wet. With what? Blood? Sweat? Slipping on the metal rack. My mother's voice in my head. Hang in there, she said. Hang in there. Like she already saw this coming. You, me, the crib, the darkness. And then finally, the shaking stops. I'm lying on my side. I'm lying in a warm, dark cave. A singing pain floating up around my body, high-pitched and clear. Breathe. Screams and sharp bursts, the metal racks creaking above us. The alarm starts again. I press my fingers against my face, my chest, my stomach. I run my hand across the dome of my belly, try to find a hard spot, your foot or maybe your elbow, to press against. But nothing. My stomach is taut, aching. Sorry, I'm just going to cough. And I'll say that again. My stomach is taut, aching. My mouth tastes of grit, eyes watering from the thick air, the smell of cardboard and dust, so much dust I can barely breathe. I need water. I need fresh air. I need to get out of here. Hello, I call out. My throat so coated in dust, the word comes out like, oh, hello? Muffled yelling, crashes that reverberate along the ground. I shift sideways, try to roll onto my forearm so I can push myself up, but I knock into the rack above me. Every time I move, I bump into something solid. All around us are walls and boxes. My feet are stuck beneath something heavy. I can't move them. I'm alone, spinning out in space. I don't want to die like this. Don't think about what's coming, the prenatal yoga teacher said. Just think about what's happening right now. I cup my belly where I think your face is, cradle you in the only way I can. It's okay, I say. We're going to be okay. I take my good hand and push the cardboard wall in front of me. It budges slightly. I use my hand to trace the walls of the cage, the metal rack above me, stacks of cardboard on all sides, heavy as bricks, nowhere to push through. Then a voice. Hello? Faint, but I can hear it. I'm here. The words out of my mouth before I can even think about it. I'm here, under here. A woman's voice. She says something, but it's too muffled. I wave my hand frantically. I know she can't see it, but I can't help myself. I'm under the rack, I scream. Can you hear me? She says, closer this time. Yes. Tears and dust in my eyes. Yes, yes, yes. Can you move at all? Not really. Try to stick your hand through a crack. I can't find one. I start hitting my hand harder, frantically, panic flickering at the edges of my body, pulling on me. I need to stay calm. What do you see? Nothing, I say. There are boxes all around me. I try to breathe, but I can't get the air into my lungs before I'm sucking in more. Hang on, she says. No, no, don't go. Just wait here. Her voice is getting harder to hear farther away. Don't leave me, I'm pleading, my voice shaky like a child's. Silence. Hello? Hello, are you there? Silence. The panic grips me from behind, wraps heavy fingers around my throat, thrashing out at the cardboard, cutting my fingers on sharp edges, but I can't stop, my breath coming hard and fast. No, 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 you can't leave me. You can't leave me here. I don't want to die here. Words spilling like marbles from my mouth. I don't even know what I'm saying. Just get me out. Get me out. I try to telepathically send a message to your father. Help me. Help me. Help me. My mother's voice. You need a plan. I don't have a plan, Mom.
Thank you so much. That's so harrowing. And it introduces us to, well, we get multiple introductions to Taylor, who is an incredibly important person and relationship for Annie in this whole catastrophe adventure. And while she's trekking later on across the wounded landscape to find her husband, she's going to re-encounter Taylor, the yellow shirt girl from the early moments, who is an employee from IKEA with whom Annie has an original confrontation over the purchase of her crib. When Annie happens to come upon Taylor, a partnership ensues and they will walk together. Annie seeking her husband and Taylor going to her young daughter's school in the hopes to find her there. This unlikely friendship represents community in a time of precarity. It's a friendship marked by radical empathy and also class and a number of other contexts that make them an unlikely pair. Tell us about Annie and Taylor and how their friendship became a site of this kind of radical empathy.
Yeah, I think I have my editor, Mary Sue, to thank for that in a lot of ways, because when I first wrote the character, I think I just intuitively was sort of using her as a foil. And, you know, when I sold the book, I knew I really wanted a deep edit of the book. I knew it was missing something and I didn't know what. And I think in sort of, you know, I think I was thinking, oh, I, you know, it needs more action or some sort of turning point or new thing, external thing that I haven't thought of yet. And, you know, I'm so thankful that I found Mary Sue and she read the book and she came back to me and said, this book is going to succeed based on the depth of Annie and Taylor's relationship. And I was like, that's it? Like, you don't have, like, I, you know, I was like, really wanted someone to be like, well, here's what you need to do. You need to like rewrite the whole thing in Pig Latin or like put the beginning at the end and the end. And like, I just need to do something like experimental, you know, and I'm very like, I'm a LaCroix, you know, I love shiny objects and trinkets. And
thanks for like, not rewriting it in Pig Latin.
Right. Right. Like I just thought something sort of like, you know, wild that I was missing. And it was just felt like such a boring edit. And she was like, yeah, that's it. Like, that's my big edit. And I was like, that's your big edit? And, you know, she had other stuff too, but like, man, she was right. She was right. It was so, I spent so much time. I probably spent months trying to deepen their relationship and trying to really get the emotional beats right. And, you know, I once heard Sheila Hedy say, you know, you have to become the person you need to become to finish the novel you're trying to write. And I don't think I understood that, you know, that has really mirrored my own life, that other female relationships have become so important, so central, that intimacy and connection and vulnerability. And, you know, these are such sort of eye roll buzzwords, but they really, you know, there's a reason they're buzzwords and they're worth the cost of admission. And so it's really has been such a challenge to make their relationship deeper. And for me, yeah, the payoff has been really enormous. And I hope that the book, you know, shows that payoff.
I mean, it was certainly, it's a massive part of my love for the novel. And you understand that first interaction they have so well, the like frustration in a moment. And then you layer in Annie's like late pregnancy and just needing to get out of that environment with a crib and really wanting a crib that will, you know, seem like a symbol of something that's stable for this child. And yet, you know, she's pretty harsh towards Taylor, and Taylor isn't exactly like super helpful. But then later on in this moment where they could have acted out those same parts, they're something completely new to each other. And I think that's what I really loved.
Yeah, you know, I based it in some ways on this relationship. That, and I don't know their names off the top of my head, but it's pretty well known. After 9/11, this man who was stuck and this other man who, like, I believe, like, scaled a wall to save him. Mm-hmm. And the two of them, you know, then were sort of walking together and became these lifelong friends, and their families are friends. And, you know, and this idea, I once wrote a story for the New York Times about how to have closer friendships. And someone that I interviewed told me, you know, well, the best way is to get in a car accident with one of your, you know, acquaintances, and then you'll be best friends.
Oh my God.
or maybe she was talking about a friend she'd had, and that's what had happened to them. And like, you know, you just have, that creates a lifelong friend. And yeah, I really think it is, I think there's these moments in life where we really get to see people for who they are and where a lot of like the minutia and noise of modern life recedes and we're able to experience some real profound humanity.
Mm. So the backstory of Annie and her husband is undergirded by both of their artistic ambitions, playwriting for Annie and acting for her husband. Marriage and the practicalities of a domestic life together and the future of parenting dampen those ambitions, at least on the surface, but Annie's husband is actively pursuing roles large and small. There's been a lot of ink spilled about women's desires to be so-called art monsters that can forego the societal expectations of motherhood and wifedom. But this is not the argument within this book. Nevertheless, Annie's sense of loss as she considers what her creative life might have been is at the forefront of her narrative. Where does the art monster live in this novel?
That's such a great point. Probably with the writer of the novel. No, this is a frequent topic among my writing friends. Yeah, you know, I think Annie is afraid to try. And I think that she right now has, you know, the practicalities of life have certainly caught up to her. But I think she wants to blame her unwillingness to try on those practicalities. But I don't think when you look at Annie's history that that is necessarily the case. And her husband is willing to try and refuses to stop trying. And the practicalities of that have also caught up with him. And so I think I was really interested, yeah, in that. You know, I'm very interested in the art monster discussion. But I think that I believe is almost a separate discussion, which is really about when you say you want to be an artist, are you really just saying you want to be famous? How do you ever separate those things? You know, how does art ever really blend with practicalities and this idea of like the millennial experience of sort of, yeah, being told we could do anything and be stars, and that really just not panning out, at least in these traditional ways of like novelists and playwrights and, you know, singer-songwriters. And I think that was more what I wanted to explore. And this, I was just so, I am very taken with the idea of potential. Like, are you who you are right now? Yeah. Am I who I am right now? Or am I the sum of my potential that hasn't, you know, I could die tomorrow. Like it hasn't happened yet. And I think Annie's trying to figure that out. You know, is Annie, or is Annie this potential that never was realized and she'll never truly get to be herself until she realizes her potential. You know, I was just really interested in that.
Yeah,
you know,
I love that. I feel like I'm now going to start thinking about myself as the some of my potential untapped yet, which is both, I guess, a driver to think about what we could become and also sort of frightening that we might, you know, be gone tomorrow.
And also, like, then many of us live our whole lives thinking we're not even really living because we don't feel like ourselves because we were supposed to be this. And it was supposed to be that. And very like, there's nice, such an entitlement. There's such an expectation, you know, and I wanted to explore all of that. And I really don't. The book, I know, does not have a clean and clear message about ambition and art monsters and money. And I truly wanted to explore it. I don't know that I have a clear answer. It just, yeah, really, really fascinates me. And part of the problem, of course, is that, you know, I was trying to meet my unmet potential by writing a book, which was my life dream. And so it has been, there has been a sort of distortion of like, in some ways, I've answered the question I sought out to ask in my own life. But at the same time, I almost answered it by just ending up with more questions.
Yeah, man. I just had a book come out myself, and I feel so the same. It was my lifelong goal and the thought of my perhaps untapped potential. And here it is. And now I have more questions.
Oh, my gosh. Wait, Chris, you have to give me advice. How does it feel on the other side of the book coming out?
Mixed. I mean, my book is one that will be read by very few people because it's an academic book. But it, you know, there's periods of bliss and just real release and happiness. And then also just like, well, what happens next? Like, I, you know, maybe I write another book, maybe I don't. So Yeah, I would anticipate. I mean, this book is going to be a real hit. So you're going to have a long tail of the bliss and happiness of people really wanting to engage you about it. But I would also be prepared for those questions to crop up.
Yeah, I once heard someone say that we all just write books to please our parents. You know, and I think
mine's dedicated to my mom. So
mine's dedicated to my parents. Yeah, I think about that a lot. That like it there that maybe in that moment there's a type of sort of reverting to your childhood self and trying to somehow finally get that sort of ultimate gold star.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So even though this is a dystopian adventure story in some ways to find Annie's husband, it is, as you've been talking about female friendship and connection, often via the idea of motherhood that is most central and essential to the narrative. There's a moment in which Taylor sees what could have been her daughter killed in the school collapse, but it is not her, and she and Annie kneel with the mother of the dead child and absorb her screams. How does the thread of motherhood from Annie's actual mother who has passed away to Taylor, a young mother, and create a through line of female connection and interdependence in Tilt?
Mm. Yeah, you know, I wrote that scene sort of post Gaza. And, you know, scene for me really was, I don't know that I would have written that scene beforehand because I don't know that I would have understood this concept that like we are the line. What I found myself saying so many times in the past year is like the line between my children and someone else's child, of course, is so clear. And at this, obviously, you know, and yet sometimes does not really feel clear at all. And, you know, the past year has really shaken me and really changed, I think, changed that scene, changed, you know, certainly a lot about the book. And that specific moment came about because I wanted to show, this idea of collective grief. And sorry, it's so hard to talk about.
No, it's such a powerful.
Yeah, I think that, okay, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say, I think that the love that we have for children is wild. It's so profound. It's so big. And that I love this idea of the universal child, you know, the communal child. And I just really wanted to show that moment, a moment of like, of real solidarity. Yeah. And so that, you know, there is a thread of motherhood in the book for sure. But I think more what I was trying to show was the animalistic nature of motherhood. And, you know, motherhood is our most giving birth, you know, becoming a mother, creating life like out of your own stomach. I mean, it's just the most bizarre, primal thing. And I really, you know, there's a scene towards the end where I believe Annie says, you know, I understand now a mother does not have to make kissy kissy noises with her mouth. You know, we have such a commercial, over sentimental understanding of what a mother is or what a parent is. And I really wanted to show the animalistic, ferocious, vital side of motherhood, which I really believe is sort of us in our most animal selves. And so for me, the journey was Annie in the beginning, a consumer shopping for a crib and a certain crib, the right crib. And at the end, you know, an animal mother.
Mm-hmm. That was beautiful. And I did not necessarily understand implicitly the connection to Gaza, but it feels so strong in that scene. I mean, that scene ruined me and I had to take a break for a moment because it was so easy for me to imagine for myself or people that I know and what that would mean. But the idea of taking on another person's grief and being willing to be the vessel for that, I think is so powerful there. This feels like a hard pivot. But before I let you go, Emma, I would love to hear a little bit about things you've been reading recently and whether you might want to recommend some things to my listeners.
Yeah, I would love that. Okay, so first, I just want to, as a shout out, say that I am a really big romance reader. And that is such a, I see now how taboo that is to say in literary circles, but I'm a really big romance reader. My favorite
I don't think anymore. I think that
really,
that, yeah. Okay. I think it's even sort of genre itself has kind of turned into something that can swallow all things.
I love that. Well, okay. So my favorite romance writer is KJ Charles. Highly recommend her. She's, I think, just so incredibly talented. I really think her talent transcends genre. Mm. I learned so much about more literary writing from her and from the way she writes. Recently, I read, Colored Television was my favorite book of 2024.
Okay.
Loved Colored Television.
Me too.
And I recently started reading, I'm like halfway through it, Rejection. I'm not going to be able to say his last name. Tony Tulamate?
Yeah. That's right, I think. Okay. Yeah.
Rejection is incredible. Rejection is so good. I wish I could say more intelligent words than that. I can only just say, like, it's so incredibly good.
Yeah. The story with the email is, the mass email is, I'll never forget it.
Oh my God. Yes. 100%. Sometimes reading that book, I tried to imagine the workshop discussions of him turning in those pages. You know what I mean? Like, and that was, but just, I mean, yeah, it just, there's some, he's just incredibly talented. That book is incredible. And yeah. I just started reading a galley of a book. I'm only like one chapter in, but I started reading it last night and the writing was so beautiful. I almost had to put it down because I think sometimes when writing is so beautiful, it bums me out. I'm like, oh, I'm never going to write that well. So I can't even bear it. It's called Great Black Hope. It's by Rob Franklin. I don't know. I think it's coming out this summer. I got given a galley of it. And yeah, and the first chapter really, like, really shook me. So I'm excited to keep reading that one.
Oh, that sounds great. Can you give us a specific one from KJ Charles, just so I can point people in that direction?
Okay, yes. Thank you for asking. Okay, so there is a book that I think is so relevant right now. It's called A Seditious Affair. And it's about two men who are, you know, completely, who fall in love with each other, but are completely on different sides of the political spectrum in a really serious way. And she deals with that with so much intellect, thoughtfulness, God, so much character building, so much work about privilege and class. Yeah, it's, this book, I've read it. It's probably one of the only books I've read maybe three or four times. And it's like, I skip past the sex scenes just to read the dialogue. Hmm. And I think that's a sign that, you know, you're either doing romance writing wrong or you're doing it right. I don't know, but she's doing something really remarkable.
Wow, that sounds so great. And just something that's not represented much in any kind of literature these days.
Totally. So,
and very, you know, worth our time to think about how that can happen and perhaps be a catalyst to thinking differently. But I mostly want my audience to know that Tilt is the novel they need to run and get. This is such a visceral novel. It's an experience of literature that I think just kind of electrified me while I was reading it. And I loved Annie so much. And I loved listening to her narrate this experience, even though it was such a scary one. I mean, there's a comparison by Lydia Kiesling to The Road. And I love Lydia and love her work. I don't think that's what this book is. And I think while it can live in that same universe of Cormac McCarthy, I think it's doing something totally new and totally different. And I loved it. And it was a great opportunity to get to talk to him.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, Chris. What a thoughtful and enjoyable interview.
Thank you so much. Well, that's all from me for now. My thanks to Emma Potti for coming on to talk about her debut novel, Tilt. You can find links to purchase Tilt and all of Emma's recommended books at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.